exact figure on those who got in the first few days, but it had to be well over 1,000. So let's put our total number at 12,000. Now back down to roughly 10,000 or so. That doesn't count the casualties from the fighting at the Gap and refugees dying outside the barrier, Tom interjected. No, I'm only counting those who died of natural causes at the moment. What I'm saying is that those who would die quickly have pretty well died off. Across the next 15 days or so, the numbers should be fairly low, as long as we keep the community stable and nothing exotic sneaks in on us. But then, I hate to say, it's going to start sliding up again, and within 30 days be far worse than anything we've seen so far. Keller hesitated, looking at John for a moment. Keller knew his secret regarding the stash of insulin. Nearly all our type 1 diabetics will die this month. The pharmacies in general allocated one bottle of 1,000 units per person. That supply is now running out for them. So we can expect all of them, approximately 120 in our communities, to start dying. No one spoke. Other deaths in the coming month? Severe asthmatics running short on their rescue inhalators. Severe heart arrhythmia patients running out of beta blockers. So I expect we are in the middle of the lull before the next wave hits. There is another issue as well, though, that I don't think many of us thought of, but, Tom, you better start gearing up for it, and we might have to start thinking about taking over a building as another isolation ward. What for? Kate asked. Severe psychosis. You mean insanity? Tom asked. Hell, we're already seeing enough crazies coming in at the Gap, and the suicides as well over the last month. I think we're all half crazy now. Well, it's going to get a lot worse within a matter of days, Keller said. Why within days? Tom interjected. About a quarter of the population was on antidepressants or anti-anxiety agents, Prozac, Xanax, Lexapro, even just plain old lithium. Most of those people rushed to the pharmacies and stocked up, but even then, on average, a person got at best a 30-day supply. They're running out now. Withdrawal for some won't be too bad. For others, symptoms will be quite severe, including hallucinations. Compound that with the stress we are under already. As an old-time doc, I'll be the first to tell you quite a few on these meds were just mildly neurotic, living in a very pampered society where it was almost obligatory to have some sort of disorder. But seriously, roughly 5% of the population do have severe disorders, and 1 to 2% dangerous disorders that include severe paranoia and potential for highly aggressive behavior. In other words, expect a lot of insanity, Tom said. You'll be the one dealing with it, Keller replied, and I think your people better be briefed on it. Not too long ago in our past, families suffered with it, keeping their crazy Uncle Louie restrained or locked away or shipped them to state hospitals, which were indeed snake pits. Where do you think the word bedlam came from? It was the hospital for the insane in 18th century England, and if you saw the old prince, a true hellhole. We haven't dealt with this ever since all the modern meds started coming out in the 60s and 70s. That and the changing of laws that pretty well stopped involuntary commitment except in extreme cases emptied the hospitals. If it was back 50 years ago, at least 100 of our fellow citizens would be already under some form of restraint, either at home or in a state institution. Now they are with us, and the medications that kept them somewhat stable are gone. Hundreds more are in varying degrees of instability as well. What I'm trying to get across is that we'll have upwards of 1,000 people in our community who are in varying degrees of psychological unbalance, not related at all to the crisis, but instead to their forced withdrawal from medications. And at least 50 to 100 will be extremely dangerous to themselves or to others. Severe paranoids, schizophrenics, delusional personalities, several living here with criminal pasts, but who were declared insane, treated, then released back into the community. I think, Charlie, you are going to have to authorize me to be able to declare people to be mentally unstable, and to then incarcerate them by force. We'll need then to find people to tend to them, and also decide how we deal with food distribution to them." Charlie sighed, rubbing his beard, and then nodded. "I authorize you to have the authority to declare a person to be mentally deranged, and to have them incarcerated, if need be against their will or that of the family. Tom, you will be responsible for arrest. I'll post that notice later today." Keller nodded. "I think in at least 30 or 40 cases we should move preemptively, meaning now, even if they still have some meds left. As a doctor, I know which of my patients were truly over the edge long before this happened. Patients who had repeated hospitalizations and incidents. Tom, you would know some of them, too, from incidents that led to their going to a psychiatric unit or jail. I think we should grab those people now, before it gets bad."
"One thing," John said quietly.
"Go on."
"Keep in the back of our minds how that power was also used to lock up those that neighbors just didn't like, political dissenters, and in a darker time the belief that insanity was satanic and the resulting witch hunts. We got a couple small churches in this community that are already preaching that this disaster is God's punishment to a sinful nation, and or that it is now the end time. I never thought about what Doc here was saying in regards to mass psychosis, but we might see some of these deranged people being seen either as prophets, if they have a good gift for gab, even though they're crazy, or, on the other side, demonically possessed."
"Damn, this is starting to sound medieval," Kate sighed.
"We are medieval, Kate," John shot back. "If we got people going off the deep end, and definitely if there is prior record of severe mental disorder, yes indeed, we'll have to lock them up, for everyone's protection. All we need is a bunch of people following some mad prophet around, or a mob stoning a witch, and it could come to that. But it's a fine line, and we can't go overboard on it. We all know the news leaking in from Knoxville about that crazy cult. We don't want even the beginnings of it here."
John looked over at Keller, who nodded in agreement.
"And one other item related to this," Keller said. "Alcohol. The rush on the ABC store pretty well cleaned it out on day one, and the looting afterwards finished it."
John found himself thinking about single malt scotch, the few ounces left in his bottle behind the desk.
"So the drunks, the hardcore alcoholics, are out by now, and that can get tough. My concern, some will try anything for a drink, trying to distill it."
"Every ear of corn goes to food," Charlie snapped. "We catch anyone trying to steal corn to turn into booze, and there will be hell to pay."
"Not that, Charlie. I mean trying to distill it out of any potential source, right down to people thinking they can get something out of hydraulic fluid. I've already got one idiot blinded because of wood alcohol. That's going to go up as well."
"A dry community," Kate chuckled softly. "We were for a long time after the Depression. Guess we are again."
"Now, down to the harder issue," Keller continued. "Food."
There were sighs around the table.
"With the cutting of rations yet again, we are, at best, doling out little more than 1,200 calories a day per person. Our reserve stockpiles are down to not much more than 10 days. I am going to have to suggest a further cut, by a third or so, to extend that out to 15 days.
"What I was thinking as well," Charlie replied.
"What about the food on the hoof? Cattle, pigs, horses?"
"We've gone through a third of that stock, and we must stretch that reserve out as long as possible."
"For how long?"
Kate asked.
"The radio, though," Tom said. "If things are coming back online down on the coast, hell! Help might be up here in another month or two. All they need is one diesel-electric locomotive, and it can haul 10,000 tons of food and supplies."
"Easier said than done," John announced. "When we got hit, every train on every track in the country stalled. It's not like a highway where you just move around it.
Once they get some locomotives working, every stalled train on every line will have to be pushed somewhere to clear the line. All switches will have to be set manually. I've been hoping the folks up at Smoky Mountain Railroad might actually get something running with their steam locomotive. Their track actually connects down into Asheville, but there hasn't been a word about it. Whatever help is coming in now, it will be from the coast. We are now like America of 200 years ago. Get a day's walk in from the coast or a major river, and you are in wilderness. So don't plan anything here with the hope that just maybe the legendary they will show up. Maybe isn't definite, Charlie replied. I agree with John on this one. Think of it, Tom. Let's say the Navy did steam into Charleston. There's a million people there without food. Anything beyond spitting distance of the sea, I'm not optimistic for right now. Doc, tell us what you are thinking. The rations are running short, Keller said, compounded by the fact that more and more of our locals are applying for ration cards as well, now that their own food stocks have run out. So even as we run out, there are more mouths to feed. John had yet to apply for ration cards for his family. He had always been proficient with a rifle, and using the .22 he had nailed several possums, a number of squirrels for the dogs, and remarkably, just the day before, a tom turkey that had been such a feast that he had invited the Robinson family up to join them, Lee Robinson actually producing a quart bottle of beer and canned corn for the occasion. Michaela had been there as well with a chocolate bar she had kept stashed away. Even the dogs had been given some scraps. The possums, well, they reminded John of the old television series where Granny was always talking about possum pie. Jen was horrified when he had brought the first one in. She tried roasting it in the stove out on the deck, a disaster. But they were learning, even though the darn things were greasy as hell. You realize that if we cut back to around 900 calories a day, we are at nearly the same level as the Siege of Leningrad. Resistance is already down. The average person has lost at least 15 pounds or more. For many, that's actually damn good, but now we start getting into the body eating itself, and not just the reserve fat most Americans carry around. Strength will be impacted significantly, and I want to talk more about that in a few minutes. For the general population on rations, the impact is going to start kicking in within the next couple of weeks. Immunological systems in everybody are weakening, meaning if that flu down in Old Fort gets up here, it will be like the 1918 epidemic that killed nearly 2 million in America. I'd estimate 10% of us dying in a matter of days if flu breaks out. I think, Charlie, that we will have to shut down our free passage through the gap or change the procedure. Lord knows how many flu carriers are walking along our interstate every day heading west. Charlie sighed and looked over at John and Tom. We do that, Tom said. There'll be more riots. Getting those people moving further west has prevented any more problems since the big riot of 2 weeks back. I agree with Tom, John said. Block the barrier, we'll have a build-up of a couple of thousand again within days, even more desperate than the first wave, and it will be a bloody fight. Let them through, but drill our people on extra caution. They're wearing the hazmat suits already, Charlie said. Yeah, and most likely taking them off with their bare hands, not washing down properly, he sighed. It'll most likely jump no matter what we do. People are not just staying on the roads. They're crawling up through the woods. I'm getting reports of that, Tom said. Strangers breaking into houses, then running back up into the woods when someone shows up. Most likely outsiders. John looked at Kate, who said nothing. The word was ingrained now across the populace. Even those who had not been inside the town on the first day but came in before the barriers went up were now using it, almost as if to say, I'm here now. I'm not one of them. Nutrition-wise, thank God, we're well into June. Scurvy is not a concern. We got enough greens of one sort or another, though the soup made out of boiled grass and dandelions is a bit rough to swallow. The first vegetables are starting to come in as well.
Throughout May, Charlie, taking a page from the memories of some of the older folks, had called for a victory garden campaign. Every last seed in town had been snapped up, and once beautiful lawns, yet another luxury of a pampered society, had been spaded over for lettuce, squash, beans, anything that could be eaten. Still, we are on the real edge now of running out.
"Damn it, Doc," Kate snapped. "We still got 40 head of cattle here, a couple of 100 hogs, the horses, and Swannanoa, maybe even more."
"One cow a day for 10,000? Keller asked. "At best, 2 ounces of meat. Less than a cheap hamburger at a fast food joint without the bread. Okay, 2 cows a day and a hog. 5 ounces of meat, barely enough. And the cows in both communities are gone, and not much more than days. Every last one. Then the horses, maybe another 10 to 12 days. Then the rest of the hogs. 70 days, max, and we've eaten our way through the lot. Then what?" "And that's at everyone getting about 1,000 to 1,200 calories a day. Then we are out of food, 100% bankrupt." He looked at Charlie. "You got a plan until next spring, 4 times longer than what we've been talking about." Charlie looked at John, who reluctantly nodded in agreement. "Don't count on anything from the outside, perhaps never. To get to us from Charleston, they'll first have to re-establish control in Columbia, then up to Greenville, Spartanburg. There are millions of people down there, just a couple of 100,000 up here. And besides, they'll think we're okay up here in the mountains. Everyone always thinks that up the mountains there'll be plenty of food."
"What about trying to send Don Barber down there with his plane?" Tom asked.
There were several nods of agreement.
"At least it'd let him know we are up here."
Charlie shook his head. "That plane is valuable beyond measure for keeping an eye on things locally. Its range, though, fully gassed, is less than 200 miles.
"We could rig up some kind of strap-on tanks to take it one way into Charleston," Tom said.
"Why?" Charlie asked.
"To get help," Tom said. "For God's sake, at least he could come back with some medicine. Doc Keller could give him a list. Antibiotics, anesthesia."
He hesitated and drew in his breath.
"Maybe even some insulin."
John looked at him, not sure how to react. It was as if a taboo had been broken, to not speak of the threat to Jennifer. He could see the look in the police chief's eyes. They were filled with compassion. John couldn't speak. A flash thought that maybe Tom was right. Surely whoever was down there would answer their appeal.
"I'm sorry, Tom."
It was Charlie, speaking softly.
"And John, God in heaven knows I'm sorry for you, too. But I have to say no."
John couldn't speak, feeling that his worst nightmare had just been laid bare before this group, that a decision he now desired was obviously for himself, and the logical one that he knew Charlie would drive for, he would be forced to agree with, even though he wanted to stand up and scream for them to agree with Tom, or he'd quit being on the council. He was embarrassed to realize he was actually trembling, eyes filling up with tears.
"It is a hard question of logic," Charlie continued, unable to look directly at John. "We definitely do have Don Barber's plane. We need that to keep an eye on the territory around us. It is crucial for the survival of all of us. We all know the rumors about various gangs starting to form up. Only Don Barber and his L3 can give us advance warning if they are coming this way. Sure, the Navy might be down there in Charleston, but John, you yourself said there's millions of people along the coast they are already tending to. And besides, I think Doc Keller would agree with me. How much insulin do you think they carry on board Navy ships? Most likely none at all. And what was down there has most likely already been used."
John lowered his head. He did not want anyone to see his tears.
"If I was in command down there," Charlie continued, his voice sad, remote, "I'd give Don Barber some platitudes, maybe a few bags of antibiotics at best, and a promise that help was on the way. I will not risk our only plane for that. And besides, worst-case scenario, they just might confiscate Don's plane, and that would be the end of it. If they are starting to rebuild down there, it will be a step at a time, Charlie continued. Restringing wire into the adjoining town, establishing order, then moving farther in. And with each step it'll mean more to feed. Get as far as Columbia, and they'll add a million or more extra people to take care of, or down the coast to Savannah another million or two. No, they're not going to come up here with relief supplies based on an appeal of a few thousand of us up in the mountains, arriving via an antique plane. There was a long moment of silence, until John finally nodded his head in agreement. "Charlie, I got a hard proposition to make," Keller said, breaking the silence. "Go on." "So far, we've been very egalitarian about the food. Everyone on the same rations, young children and expectant and nursing mothers the only exemptions for getting extra, something absolutely no one would object to. But you do have to consider that we might have to categorize." "What?" John, rousing from his shock regarding trying to get insulin, could see it coming, and looked over at Charlie. Charlie just did not seem to be in form. Quick decisions were coming slower now. Was it just simple exhaustion, or could it be something else? "Higher rations for the police force, those doing hard labor, and the militia," Keller said.
"I don't like this," Kate interjected. "The old line from Animal Farm that pigs are more equal than other animals?"
"Kate, the level for rations has dropped below maintaining efficiency for doing anything much beyond getting out of bed and then just sitting all day. We got people up trying to contain that fire along Haw Creek. Guys fighting forest fires used to get high-energy diets of upwards of 4,000 or more calories a day. Same with soldiers. You can't expect people to do hard work on 900 calories a day. If we do, in 3 more weeks everyone will be in collapse, too weak to even start bringing in the harvest from the few farms with corn, let alone defend the gap, contain people wandering around insane." Keller's voice died off, and he just sat there, numb.
"We have to do it," John said.
"John, I kind of thought you'd be on my side in this," Kate replied.
John shook his head. "Precedents throughout history. Ancient and medieval cities under siege, soldiers always received more rations. Though it was more for a psychological and morale impact during World War II, our rationing was always directed towards getting resources to the men on the front line. In every other country in that war, the rationing was very real, and at times," he hesitated, "a form of triage. Doc mentioned Leningrad. There they had to make the hard assessment that there simply wasn't enough food for everyone to stay alive, so it came down to soldiers, and then essential workers getting enough to keep going. Another level down for expectant and new mothers, children, and..." He stopped speaking and looked back at Keller.
"We have just over 10,000 souls in our communities. About enough food still on hand to keep 1,000, maybe 2,000, in top health until autumn, when we'll at least get some small amount of food in from the cornfields and orchards. We try and feed everyone at the same level. I doubt if many will survive, dying from both starvation and also being overrun by desperate people from the outside more hungry than us. Long before that, what semblance of order we have will totally break down as well."
"Sweet Jesus! Are we talking about deliberately starving some of our people to death?" Kate cried. "This is America, for God's sake!"
No one spoke for a moment. For John, it was the word America that hit. The land of milk and honey. The land where obesity had been considered a major health issue, almost a national right, with food chains boasting about who had the biggest, fattest burger. He often wondered, even then, what reaction there would be if such ads had been sent to Liberia, Yemen, or Afghanistan, showing America's excessive waste. "Deliberately starving people to death is putting it rather bluntly," Keller replied defensively.
"Death is rather blunt,"
Kate shot back. It's the harsh reality, John said, his voice distant. It is that simple. We have X amount of food and Y amount of people. The formula collapses in the next couple of weeks. The Y amount of people is going to have to be subdivided if any are to survive.
We have to do it, Charlie said, his voice soft.
Well, I'm not going along with it, Kate said.
Remember, Kate, this is not a democracy at the moment. If you wish not to go along with it and stop drawing rations, that is fine with me.
The rest of you here? Kate shouted. Now you do have Animal Farm. You have the commissars and the famines in Russia. Do you think people will stand for it?
Personally, I'm not going to draw extra rations, Charlie said.
Charlie, Doc interjected, you have to. I know your health. Remember, I was your family doc. You have a touch of hypertension and acid reflux. You're slowing down even now. Everyone in this room can see it.
It's just exhaustion, Charlie replied sharply.
Let me get a good night's sleep, undisturbed.
Bullshit, Doc snapped.
You're doing the work of two men and eating the same as everyone else. You'll burn out. You are burning out.
Well, it'd be one hell of a note to announce we're going to starve a lot of people around here, and I'm walking around fat and happy. Screw that.
John lowered his head. He's right, John whispered. Though I disagree on one point. Not a word of this is to be discussed publicly.
You do sound like a commissar now, Kate shouted.
He glared at her. Think I like what I just said? John replied sharply.
But, Charlie, if you go outside and say that some are now going to get more rations, it will be a riot within the hour.
I'd suggest we quietly move some extra rations up to the college campus. What we're talking about primarily applies to them anyhow. Those getting extra food get it there and there only. But as for Charlie's personal example, that's his decision, and I'll have to say the moral one.
Charlie nodded and slowly sat down.
Moving food in secret? Secret eating while others starve? Kate shook her head. I never dreamed we'd come to this point so fast, and agree to it, here, right here in our town.
The first that would get hit by the rioting are the outsiders, John said. There's been a semblance of acceptance, some bonding, that would disintegrate, Kate, and I'm willing to bet would turn into murders and lynchings. A massive scream to throw everyone out who wasn't living here the day of the event. Then our two communities will start glaring at each other. Frankly, Swannanoa has more food per person than we do, a lot more, with their extra cattle and hogs. We'll split, and those here will start screaming about marching there to take their cattle.
You hear that, Kate? It's like something out of ancient history, the Bible. We'll be raiding each other for cattle. Then it will be every man for himself, and we'll all die as a result if someone from the outside, with some organization and strength, then comes rolling in. There's your choice, Kate. Go ahead. What should we do?
She glared at him, unable to reply. John looked over to Tom, who had remained silent throughout the debate, and Tom nodded in agreement.
I know I couldn't keep order. I'd have to call in the college militia, and even there most of those kids would be defined as outsiders as well, and the mob ready to turn on them. It would be a hell of a mess, Kate. John's right, we have to do this, but we have to keep it quiet.
So, in other words, hoard some food for a select few, do it in secret, so that by the time the rest of the people figure it out, they'll be too weak to act.
John stared at her.
Yes.
You bastards.
Kate, it's been this way throughout history. America, though, hasn't faced it since... He paused. Maybe parts of the South in the Civil War. Even then, that was just limited. We've never seen anything like this before. But in reality, it has to be done if any survive. We can't keep social order, defend ourselves, and at the same time give out some kind of equal amounts of food to everyone else. If we try that, everyone will die.
I won't accept extra food.
No one is forcing you to, John said softly.
Kate,
"You cannot discuss this outside this room," Charlie said sharply. She glared at him.
"Or what?"
"I'll have you arrested."
"Sieg Heil, mein Führer!"
And she raised her hand in the fascist salute. "Damn it, Kate!" Charlie snapped, his voice almost breaking. "I don't want this any more than you, so don't ride me on it." She lowered her head. "It has to stay in this room," John said sharply.
"Are you getting an extra?" Kate asked.
"Hell no. We're still getting by."
"All right, Charlie. You don't take extra rations. None of us here do, and I'll go along with it."
"Tom has to be on the list for extra rations," Keller said. "Like hell!" John looked at Tom. His rotund pre-war form had melted away quickly, belt drawn in now by several notches. "All police, firefighters, the militia, those doing essential work," John said, "and gravediggers." There was a long silence. "And Doc, you too," John said. Doc nodded. "I won't hide behind false heroics. I hate the thought, but I know my performance is degrading fast. I set a compound fracture yesterday. One of the Quincy boys fell off a horse. I thought I was going to faint towards the end of it. If we don't have doctors and nurses in this town who can function, well, we're all dead anyhow then."
"How many will we lose?" Charlie asked.
"When?"
"You said the curve is going to start going up again. How many do we lose in 2 or 3 months?
Doc looked around the room.
1/3 to 1/2, if we follow the plan just outlined.
And if we don't?" Kate asked.
"We drag it out a little longer, Kate, but not much more than 30 days extra. Then everyone will be dead by winter."
No one spoke.
"Malthus is finally being proven right," Charlie said. "Our population here is 3-4 times higher than the carrying capacity. It was all about infrastructure. Out in Southern California right now, I bet hundreds of thousands of tons of vegetables are rotting. The Midwest will be up to their eyeballs in unpicked corn in another 6 weeks, but there is no way to get that from there to here."
Silence. And John knew all were dwelling on food, the standard thoughts of someone going into starving and malnutrition. He could picture the hundreds of thousands of head of cattle out in Texas and Oklahoma. For that matter, just 200 miles east of here, the hog farms. They were contemptible, usually rammed into poorer communities, 5 to 10,000 hogs raised at a clip in sheds where they could barely move from birth until slaughter, the stench and pollution killing property value for miles around. And to have one of them here now would be greeted with people falling on their knees and thanking God. But even then, John realized, it wouldn't work. The farms were dependent on hundreds of tons of feed being shipped in each week. If those farms had not already been looted, the waste going on was most likely beyond imagining. The animals starving to death. People who almost thought meat was grown inside a pink foam package, now trying to chase a hog down, kill it, and dress it. No, they'd cut off what they could. Others would join in like vultures, and half of it would then just rot in the sun. If the hogs escaped, they would be into the woods now, wild boar in short order and damn dangerous. Charlie finally stirred.
"Anything else?"
Silence.
"Minor point, but it's starting to get dangerous. Dogs."
John looked over at him.
"A lot of dogs are starting to run loose now. They're starving, and they're going wild. We had an incident up on 5th Street last night. 2 children got cornered by a pack of dogs. Fortunately, the father had a shotgun and dropped several of them. The rest took off."
After the grimness of the previous conversation, John knew he shouldn't be reacting so hard, but he suddenly felt a tightness in his throat. The 2 fools, Zack and Ginger, were indeed getting hungry, begging ferociously at every meal, and yet still the family would share a few scraps. Most of the squirrels John had dropped over the last week had been tossed to the dogs raw.
I think we have to order the shooting of all dogs in the town, Charlie said.
No, damn it, no, Tom snapped. I'll burn in hell before I'd go home and in front of my kids take Rags outside and blow his brains out. No way. If they're running loose and proving to be a danger, sure, but not that.
What did the father do with the bodies of the dogs he shot? Keller asked quietly.
Jesus, I never thought of that, Charlie replied.
How many dogs in this town? Keller asked. At least a couple of thousand. That's enough meat for full rations for 3 or 4 days at least. Half rations for a week and a half.
You can go straight to hell, Doc,
Tom shouted, and John was surprised to see tears in Tom's eyes. For the first time since this crisis had started, from the initial panic, the executions, the fight at the Gap, it was now Tom who was breaking into tears.
We got Rags the week my youngest was born. He's been with us 10 years, as much a part of the family as any person. He died to defend us, and frankly, I'd do the same for him. I'm not giving him up, and that's final.
Tom, what I was talking about earlier, Keller said, that's only the first starve off. I didn't even have the heart to talk about the second starve off. Those that survive into the fall, chances are, by the end of the winter, most will be dead anyhow. Do you think any dogs will still be alive by then? And if so, they'll be feral, reverting back to packs of wolves, killing people to survive.
Help will be here long before then, Tom shouted. It's starting already. You heard what John said. Charlie, I don't care what the hell you order. I will not do it to Rags or any other dog that the owners are still taking care of.
Tom was red-faced. In John's eyes, almost like a boy in a sentimental movie about a dog or other beloved pet, the obligatory scene when the kid is about to lose the dog. But we all know that at the end of the film, except an old yeller and the yearling, things will be okay. And as for those two films, John had seen both as a kid and refused to ever see them again. He was in tears now, thinking of Zack and Ginger. How would Jennifer react? Ginger was her buddy, the two inseparable. It was terrifying enough trying to avoid the fate looming for Jennifer, but to do that to her, to kill Ginger? No, John would refuse as well. And he knew as well that in his heart, even without Jennifer, he would reach the same conclusion.
I'm siding with Tom, John said.
John, we have to leave sentiment behind, Keller said.
It's more than that, John snapped back. It's yet another step backwards in who we are.
John, 10 minutes ago you agreed to letting some people starve faster than others. What in hell do you mean about stepping backwards?
I know this is illogical. It's just that we're Americans. We and the Brits especially are alike in this. We see something more in our pets than just brute beasts. For old people alone, they're a final source of comfort and love. For children, the beloved buddy that understands even when adults don't.
He was ashamed. He was starting to cry.
I'd kill every dog in the town if I could save one life by it, Keller snapped back.
That will take something out of us forever. Maybe a line I don't want to cross. Would rather not live in...
No.
The line is there, Keller replied. It is there, no matter what.
Charlie stirred.
How about this, then? Loose animals will be shot and given to the communal food supply. Owners must keep pets inside or leashed. If an owner decides to dispatch a pet on their own, they can keep it for their own food supply. Is that agreeable?
Tom jumped on it and nodded.
Fine, then. And every day they'll lose weight that could be turned into food, Keller snapped, and eat food that people will give to them, even as they're starving.
That's their choice, Tom replied.
He seemed ashamed of his emotional display, wiped his face, and stood up.
Anything else, Charlie?
Charlie shook his head sadly.
John, that broadcast we should monitor from now on. We'll pull an old car radio, get some batteries, and rig out an antenna.
Good idea.
Maybe they'll be coming soon, Charlie said hopefully.
Sure, Charlie. Maybe they will.
John left the meeting and started for home. The radio was now set on a dial to the Voice of America channel, but it was only static. Maybe a whisper of a voice for a second or two, then static again. He thought of stopping in to see Hamid, perhaps try to trade something for a few cigarettes to round out his day, even though it was still only mid-morning. The meeting had worn him to the edge. He opened the glove compartment. Extra ammo for the Glock strapped to his side was in there, along with what he called his reserve, a cigarette. He lit it up, inhaling deeply as he pulled onto State Street and drove past the elementary school. The once beautiful front lawn was now ragged, beat down, torn out in places. Some kids were down in the playground playing baseball. They already looked skinnier to him, reminding him of photos of German kids playing in the rubble after World War II. The cook fire was going. Today it was Horse. One of the older beasts, close to death, had been shot. A crowd was gathered round it, butchering it, legs sticking up. Yet another memory of a World War II film, of German civilians in rubble-strewn Berlin hacking at a dead animal. One of Tom's men standing by, shotgun cradled casually under his arm, was watching the proceedings. Everything, every ounce of fat, bone, innards, everything, would go into the kettle. Some greens would be mixed in, and there were at least 50 or more people standing around listlessly, watching every move hungrily. John passed the school, continued on, the interstate to his left. Michaela's Beamer, still resting where it had rolled to a stop 35 days ago. He was tempted to drive the extra mile up to the isolation hospital, stand outside, and call for her. If he stepped in, he was stuck there for at least 3 days. He missed her. He slowed, drove past the turnoff to his house, and continued on, but then, on reaching the turn to the conference center, he figured he'd better not. So he continued on, driving several hundred more yards to a bridge that spanned over the interstate just behind the gap. He got out of the car, nursing his cigarette for one more puff before he got down to the filter. The sound of the car running caused some of his old students, standing guard on the bridge, to turn. At the sight of him, they waved. His old students, my kids, he always called them. Hell, Mary and I were the same age when we met, and no one could have defined us as kids to ourselves, and she most definitely was not a kid at 20. He remembered so many insane nights with her, when neither got a wink of sleep till dawn, and then they went to classes. And yet now, the years stretching away, those standing guard were indeed kids in his eyes. They were uniformed. Blue jogging trousers of the college, blue long-sleeve shirts, college baseball caps, and guns. Several were in the baggy white hazmat suits. One of the girls, hunting rifle poised, was talking across the double barrier of stalled cars to a band of refugees on the other side. She had sat in his 101 class only the semester before. Cute. Yes, a bit sexy-looking, with her long blonde hair, blue eyes, and tight blouses. But still, just a kid to him now. His own daughter, not much more than 2 years younger. And now his former student stood with rifle poised, drilled to fire if anyone did indeed try to scramble over the cars and break through. One of the doctors, helped by a nurse, both in biohazard suits, was walking along a line of refugees who had been admitted through the barrier, looking at old driver's licenses, interviewing, maybe finding the one or two who might be allowed to stay, their skills on the checklist John and Charlie had created. Anyone who worked with steam, electricians, doctors, farmers, precision tool and die makers, oil and gas chemists, the list went on. Someone was culled out of the line and stepped forward. He anxiously looked back and was then relieved when a woman and 3 children were allowed to follow him. 5 more mouths, John thought. He hoped the trade in skills was a damn good one, as they were led off via a path to where Michaela worked. Someone with a hand-pumped weed sprayer now walked down the line, spraying down each person in turn with a mixture cooked up by Keller. At least it would take care of lice, fleas, but also was a psychological tool to remind them that they were somehow different once past the line and would be kept apart. The group set off, led and followed by two students in biohazard suits who were toting shotguns. Behind the cavalcade, a Volkswagen Bug followed, Black Mountain Militia stenciled on the side. Inside were a student and one of Tom's policemen. Any weapons confiscated from the line of refugees piled in the back, to be returned once they reached the far side of the barrier at exit 59.
"Hey, Colonel, sir!"
It was Washington Parker up by the barrier. John waved. Parker waved for him to come down, and there seemed to be an urgency to his gesturing. The refugees were now filing under the bridge, and the sight was heartbreaking. They wore ragged, torn, filthy clothing, several pushing supermarket shopping carts with children piled inside. John went to the edge of the bridge to slide down the embankment to the road.
"Good morning, Colonel, sir."
Startled, he saw one of his students lying in the high grass dressed in hunting camo, face darkened green. It was Brett Huffman, one of his ball players. A darn nice kid, backwoods type from up in Madison County, baseball scholarship with a real interest in history, and wanted to teach high school. A kid who was a natural leader and looked up to by his classmates. John noticed the black sergeant stripes stenciled on his hunting jacket. He had a wad of tobacco tucked into his jaw.
"Brett, just what the hell?"
John started to ask.
"Vinnie Bartelli is on the other side of the bridge, staked out like me. If there's any trouble at the barrier, or any of them folks down there try and bolt—"
He said nothing for a moment, just patted the 30-30 Savage with mounted scope.
"I had to shoot one yesterday, sir. Good shot, though. Got him in the leg, thank God. Didn't have to kill him."
John couldn't reply. There was a bit of tightness in Brett's voice, but already the sort of casualness John had heard so often in debriefings after Desert Storm. Good young kids trained to be killers and trying to be hardened to it, though it was still a shock.
"I guess, though, with a 30-30 through the leg, he's a goner anyhow."
"You did what you had to do," John offered reassuringly.
"Still, sir, reminded me of my first deer. Same kind of feeling. Maybe a bit worse."
"Take care of yourself, Brett."
"Yes, sir."
John slid down the embankment and out onto the road. He looked back. Brett was impossible to see. It registered. So many of the college kids from small towns, more than a few hunters or Boy Scouts or just outdoor types, of course they'd learn, and darn quick. The refugees were moving along on the other side. A long, strung-out column. They moved slowly, a few listlessly looking up at John. They were like something out of another age. Some so obvious, caught ill-prepared. A man in a three-piece business suit, scuffed, worn dress shoes, bandage around his head. Looked like a lawyer or upper-level corporate type, with no skills to sell here for a bowl of watery soup. Parents, side by side, exhausted, pushing a shopping cart, the wheels worn, squeaking, two children inside, both asleep, pale-faced. Some refugees were actually barefoot. Few had realized on that first day what a premium would soon be placed on shoes, good shoes, for walking, a lot of walking. He cursed himself for not thinking of it as well, and grabbing some extra pairs from the camping supply store the first day. Civil War campaigns had often hinged on which side had better shoes, which usually wore out in little more than a month of tough campaigning. Those hiking 150 miles in wingtips, or even just plain old canvas tennis shoes, were soon down to nothing, and more than one walking by actually had a different shoe on each foot. A woman who reminded him a bit of Michaela on the first night, very sexy gray business jacket and skirt, stockings still on but absolutely shredded, heels knocked off her shoes to try to make them more walkable, was limping along. She caught his eye, forced a smile, and brushed back her greasy, limp hair.
"Hi, my name's Carol," she said,
and moved towards the median barrier, her hand extended. He could see the lost world in her. Sharp, professional-looking woman, intelligent face, sexy, and using it to advantage, the hand extended for a warm handshake to start the meeting, which she was used to having go her way.
"Ma'am, step back and away."
It was one of his students, face concealed in the hazmat suit with rifle leveled.
"Keep on the white line of the road as you were told."
Carol stopped, looking back.
"I just wanted to say hi."
The student shouldered her rifle.
"Ma'am, please move back. I will shoot if you try to go over that barrier."
The other refugees in the line looked back. A few froze. Others immediately scrambled to the far side of the road.
"The rest of you," the student shouted, "do not attempt to leave the road."
Carol looked at John appealingly.
"What kind of place is this?"
she said, and her voice started to choke.
"We're a town trying to stay alive," John said.
"Ma'am?"
John held up his hand toward the student.
"At ease there. Lower your weapon. I'll handle this."
"Colonel, sir, don't let her get any closer to you. I don't want to see you under quarantine."
"Colonel?" Carol asked, still forcing the professional business smile as if just introduced.
"You are the officer in charge, then. I'm pleased to meet you."
He tried to smile.
"Former colonel, college professor now. And no, I am not in charge here."
"I saw some of your people separating that family off and leading them away. Word on the other side of your fence is that if people have specialized skills, you're letting them stay."
John took that in. If this was indeed known on the other side, security would have to be tightened. People would think up any kind of skill or profession and lie their way through the interview.
"Are they being allowed to stay?"
"I don't know,"
John lied.
"They asked us what we did. Is that it?"
"Really, miss, I don't know."
"Look, I'm a public relations consultant with Reynolds Tobacco."
She looked at the student with the gun still aimed at her.
"Colonel, to be frank, your operation needs some upgrading, a better interface with the public. I can help you set up a plan for that in no time that can help you avoid a lot of problems in the future."
It was a delivery, a sales pitch, cool, professional. And listening to her broke his heart. She actually was used to winning that way, and believed it would work now.
"I'm sorry, miss. I don't make that decision here. The doctor and the police do. I'm sorry."
And in that instant, her professional business poise, a vestige of the old world, collapsed. She took a step closer, and now it was both hands out in a gesture of appeal.
"Please, let me stay."
He couldn't respond.
She took a step closer. "Do you want to sleep with me?" Carol asked. "I'm serious. Let me stay. You like me?"
She looked down at herself in her ragged suit.
"Once I get cleaned up, believe me, you'll like me."
And she looked at him with head slightly turned now, eyes widening.
"You have a tub at home? I'd love a bath, and when you see me then, you'll really like me. You can even help me bathe. I know you'd like that."
"Carol, please don't," John said. "Don't do this to yourself. Please don't."
She broke down, sobbing.
"Don't do this to myself,"
she cried, her voice rising to near hysteria.
"Offer you a piece to stay alive? 3 nights ago I was raped, raped by 4 men, who said they had some food hidden in a shack. I half expected it, but was so damn hungry I no longer cared. Do you hear that?"
"I'm sorry," she sobbed.
"And they gave me a bowl of watery soup in the morning. One of them did, and I felt it was damn near worth the trade. Please, Colonel, I'll spend the night with you if you let me stay and just give me a little something to eat."
And then she just stepped forward, heading towards the median barrier.
"I'll shoot!"
the student guard screamed. John held his hands out appealingly, looking towards his student.
"Don't!"
The rifle went off, Carol screaming, ducking down, the other refugees flinging themselves to the pavement. Either the guard had fired high, or in her nervousness had missed, but the girl was already working the bolt, the ejected shell casing ringing loudly as it hit the pavement.
"Next one is to the head!"
the student was screaming.
"Carol, don't move!"
He started to move towards the medium barrier. The hell with the quarantine.
Colonel, don't!
It was Washington Parker running up, Colt 45 drawn, but something now seemed to tell him to holster his pistol, the sight of it ready to trigger a panic. He stepped in front of the student.
"Point that gun straight up, please,"
he said calmly, and she obeyed. Next he turned towards the refugees.
"A mistake, people. Nothing more. Please keep moving. There's plenty of fresh water at exit 64. You can rest a bit and wash up there."
He pointed to the family with the children in the shopping cart. "I bet your little ones need a bath. It's just around the bend in the road, but you must stay in the center of the road." They started to get to their feet and move back towards the white stripe dividing the two lanes. Washington approached Carol, but not too closely.
"Ma'am, please stand up. No one will hurt you if you please stand up and back away from the median barrier."
"Do as he says, Carol," John interjected. Shaking, she stood up. John looked at her, and it was as if she was a different person, that the final shreds of pride, of decency within her, had disintegrated. A woman who but 6 weeks back most likely had a corner office, a parking slot with her name on it, a liberal expense account, and a damn good stock option, had just tried to sell her body for a place to rest for a night and a bowl of soup. "Carol, are you all right?" She said nothing, features almost blank, turned, and fell back into the line of refugees. Something told him with grim certainty she would not live much longer, shattered to the point that a razor blade across the wrists would be a welcomed relief. He was tempted to call her back, and he stepped over the medium barrier and actually took a step towards her.
"Colonel, sir."
He looked back. It was Washington, shaking his head no. Washington turned back on the student who had fired the shot.
"Was that a warning shot, or were you aiming at her?"
Washington said.
"I'm not sure,"
and her voice was near breaking.
"You were wrong on two counts," Washington snapped.
And the girl was now at attention, trembling.
"That woman had not yet tried to go over the barrier. Your orders are only to shoot if they go over the barrier, or try to turn on you."
"She was getting close to Professor the Colonel, sir."
"I am not sir. I am Sergeant Parker. Remember your orders and abide by them. Now, the second count. Was that a warning shot or not? Remember, I told all of you I am the only one to give a warning shot. If you shoot, then do it to kill. A warning shot is a wasted bullet, and we've got precious few of them."
"I think I aimed at her."
Washington snatched the gun from the girl.
"Go back up to the barrier. You can help interview the refugees. I'm sending someone who has the guts to aim right to your place."
The girl, crestfallen, turned and walked away, her shoulders beginning to shake. Parker shouted for one of the boys by the barrier to walk escort with refugees, and John came up to his side.
"A bit hard, perhaps?"
Washington asked. John shook his head.
"I've told my girls repeatedly, if you are going to shoot, shoot to kill. But that pathetic woman did not deserve to be shot at."
"I know," Washington sighed.
"What did she do? Offer to sleep with you?"
"Yes."
"I get it 20 times a day, and it's not because I'm good-looking,"
Washington said, his attempt at a joke falling flat.
"Sick. I'm hearing more and more stories up here about rape, murder, stealing, even of baby formula. It's getting desperate on the road. You were going to offer to let her stay, weren't you?"
"Yeah, you could see it. She's far over the edge. I think she'll be dead in a few more days." The two looked towards Carol, who was at the back of the column, staggering along. Washington sighed.
"Yeah, God save 'em. You're right. You can look at these people and tell who still just might pull through. Poor woman, she's not one of them. No place in this world for her now, and what she has left to sell is fading."
John lowered his head.
"Damn all this," he sighed.
I'm now seeing hundreds like her every day, Washington said wearily. Sir, we let one in beyond those that can help us all survive. We break down.
He couldn't reply.